Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Our federal budget and what it's likely to deliver, what it should deliver, and I know our guest is not going to be unwilling to go out on a limb and tell us what it will deliver. Moshe Lander joins us, economist at McGill University. His fields include business, economics, and international trade. And Moshe, how are you today?
Hello.
Good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to be on with you.
So what are you expecting? What are the givens as far as what Ms. Freeland is going to deliver on the 28th is concerned?
I think we're going to hear a little bit of a discussion about healthcare. That was kind of the big accomplishment in the last few months. And so the great thing with the budget is that sometimes you get to play the greatest hits all over again. It's not new spending per se, because there's already this agreement, but it's going to be presented as if this is a major budgetary issue. We're probably also going to hear something about how to deal with inflation. And I think it's going to be very targeted. Rather than broad measures, inflation is coming down. I don't know that it's going to be a problem in 6 months, but it is a problem now. And so I think for the government to just shrug and say, just ride this one out and we'll be good, probably not the best thing to do. So maybe some targeted spending to just try and keep some people happy. And of course, the other thing is what they've been harping on for years, which is the environment. And I think the Inflation Act in the U.S. has maybe scared a lot of countries, Canada included, that if they don't get moving on green energy and green initiatives, they could be left in the dust. And so I think that they're going to start to try and lay out some sort of roadmap for how that works. I think beyond that, maybe a little bit of a discussion of when they plan on balancing the budget, little tweaks here and there to the tax code and things like that. And we should have a fun afternoon.
A fun afternoon. I like that. What would surprise you if we get a certain announcement that is not outside the realm of the possible, maybe not expected, but what would surprise you?
So I think, you know, the government at some point has to deal with its lack of defense spending. I don't know that this is necessarily the time, but it's got to come sooner or later. They can't keep ignoring this. And as Russia continues to muckrake in Ukraine, and as we're now discussing Chinese involvement in Canada's elections and just kind of global instability in general, Canada has an obligation to fulfill some of its NATO promises. This could conceivably be the budget where they start to maybe tip their hand as to what they plan, but it would be within the realm of possibility, but a surprise if I heard it.
Do you think this budget that we're going to hear on the 28th will have been affected by what Mr. Xi, President Xi, will have told President Putin when they visited in Moscow?
I don't know that it's going to have a huge effect, right? Remember, Roy, like it's not like they're actually working on the budget up until Wednesday. It's probably, you know, already in the can. And at best, it's maybe fine-tuning the speaking points and maybe adjusting a couple of numbers here and there. But I think this is mostly done. I don't know that meeting is going to fundamentally change Canada's security concerns. We have one of the players, you know, causing trouble in Europe, and the other one is ready to cause trouble in Asia. And, you know, Canada has a very large, extensive Arctic that would be desirable by both countries. And so there is a national security element here that goes beyond just what's going on in the rest of the world. It could have impacts here at home in the coming decades.
We've spoken a lot about the overall picture of the economy of this country. And then we've talked about what the business community requires in order to continue to keep moving forward and productively. Do you expect this government is going to have something for the business community that is going to be indicative of their interest in the business community and will deliver on promises, maybe promises is a strong word, with any federal government? Do you think they're going to deliver on expectations?
If it's the clean industry, yeah, I think that they're going to be helpful in this budget. If it's the dirty part of the industry here in this country, I don't think that they're going to be offering much in the way of help other than just a warning that get ready, your day is coming. You know, we've talked about electric vehicles, batteries. There's that big factory that's going to the built in St. Thomas, just south of London, you know, critical minerals and things like that. That stuff is all kind of important in the story here. I think what the Canadian business industry more than anything needs right now is merely just clarity and some idea of where they stand and what to expect, right? They don't want any surprises. The last 3 years have been nothing but, mostly beyond the control of the government. But I think if nothing else, if they can just outline, we don't plan on disrupting anything, that in itself could be just a huge boost to business.
What's the most productive move the government can make?
No new taxes. I'm going to go all George Bush on you here.
I like the sound of no new taxes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would at this point. And I think that if they can say that we can work within our existing means right now, we don't need to broaden taxes out. We don't need to talk about changing anything fundamentally. We don't need to look at going after the wealthy or trying to take some sort of estate grab and things like that. If they can keep just the existing status quo, you know, again, that's the type of clarity that keeps people calm. There is the possibility that a recession could be coming later this year. And so level-headedness is extremely valuable at this point. And if the government can show that they remain confident and level-headed, that speaks volumes.
So if we look at the agreement that the Liberals have with the New Democrats, and I spoke with Jagmeet Singh about that on the air 2 weeks ago, and we've played back various parts of that interview on a couple of occasions since then. Do you think that that agreement and what is implied and what is essentially promised, is it going to play a major part in the budget on the 28th, or is it just going to be an outlier?
No, you need to have the NDP support in order to maintain your role in government here. And so since, you know, the budget is always kind of an up and down confidence motion as well, I think that you're going to see some of the NDP paw prints on this thing. The problem, of course, is that the NDP fundamentally will always want more spending, any spending. But the problem is that when we're talking about that inflation might be finally being wrestled under control, you have this competing interest that if you do spend, you could be a source of inflation yourself, necessitating higher interest rates by an independent central bank. So I think that the Trudeau government has a very fine line to walk here where they do need to satisfy some of those NDP requirements to maintain their support, and some spending might be necessary. But I think that it has to be targeted then. Try and appeal to the NDP's key constituents to allow them to say, we got something for you. But don't create such a huge level of spending that it leaves an inflationary imprint on this country.
So can you summarize for me then what you think we're going to be hearing on the 28th when we all get together and we all start to discuss, whether it's on the airwaves, whether it's in the halls of power in Ottawa or provincial capitals, what are we going to come away with? What do you expect?
So I think that we're going to hear a lot of confidence. The best way to minimize the damage of a recession is to be confident. If you get all negative, that just makes a recession much likelier and much deeper. So, you know, the government's going to present that the deficit is smaller than what they had anticipated even back in November. They're going to show that they have a vision for what Canada should look like with a cleaner initiative. They're going to show that they are a compassionate government. They're ready to help people that are most in need and affected by inflation. They stand ready with dry powder to jump in if the economy does go into recession. And so they're going to try and present this idea that they're in control, they're confident that Canada is strong, and it's ready to meet its future needs for the environment and its role within the world. And I think at the end of the day, what we're going to be left with is that the major announcement of healthcare spending has already been made. So other than kind of that recap and other than maybe a few targeted measures, it's really going to be a lot of the status quo then to just try and get through and see what things look like in 6 months' time, whether we are, in fact, in a recession or not.
All right. Moshe, what about the reality that we're living with now as far as our economy is concerned and our economic opportunities and responsibilities are concerned? How's this all going to play into the picture? Because not too far down the road, there's another fairly regular event called an election.
Yeah, you know, I was looking, Roy, at some data last week, 2 weeks ago. one of the things that had me concerned was the size of government spending in this country has almost doubled in a decade. And a lot of that is not because of COVID. At some point, we're starting to reach a natural limit of just how big the government can be and how much we can expect it to do. I think that the worrying exercise now is that in lead up to an election, you're certainly going to hear from the conservatives that they want to shrink the government. And that might not be an unreasonable thing. But I think, of course, the NDP wants to expand the government, and the Liberals are going to get pinched here as they approach an election as to how do they want to approach the government and what it does. Depending on which side they fall out on is probably going to dictate to some extent their electoral prospects in that upcoming election. So, I think that they can't grow indefinitely, and they do have some major issues coming up. Like I said, defense is one of them. That healthcare cost, of course, is never going to get smaller as society ages. And there's a massive amount of infrastructure to hold this big country together that needs to be addressed at some point. So with all of these big spending initiatives, at some point, the government's going to have to really take a hard look at what else is it going to be able to afford without raising taxes on Canadians and meet its obligations to Canadians.
You know, it's true. You say they're going to have to take a look at and see what they can afford. And people know on an individual basis, on a family basis, they know how difficult it is to make ends meet. And they know how difficult it is to meet budgetary expectations, whether it's family or individually. So there's this right in my own living room aspect to the budget. And then there's the big picture aspect to this budget. So when it comes to the budget's release, do you think that Canadians are going to, by and large, and let's not take politics out of the picture here, do you think the Canadians, by and large, are going to feel confident, going to feel that something positive was done by the Trudeau government as far as the federal budget is concerned, or do you think that they're going to exercise or engage in another exercise of shooting yourself in the foot is concerned?
You know, I think that there's maybe a general fatigue with the Liberal government that we're starting to reach in Canada. So, you know, unless they make some sort of major announcement, we're going to balance the budget in the next couple of years, or we're going to reduce the GST, or, we're going to do something that really grabs a headline. I think there's an element of, in the 5-minute summary that'll be at the top of any newscast after the budget, it's going to be, am I expecting a check in the mail in the next 6 months? No, then really there's nothing in the budget that affects me at the micro level. And I think that a lot of Canadians are going to walk away feeling that the budget will have failed to deliver on their micro level concerns, right? It's how do I get through the next 6 months? How am I going to deal with these higher interest rates? How am I going to make sure that I keep my home? How am I going to make sure that I keep food on the table and not experience double digit increases? And the budget is not designed for and will not deliver on any of those issues. So I think that missing that grand announcement, Canadians are just going to shrug and say that they missed an opportunity here, not realizing what really should have been done, could have been done, or needed to be done.
Huge story internationally over the last number of days, last week. And that is the story of the president of China, Xi Jinping, visiting with his, what are they, friends for life? With his best friend for life? What's his name? Oh, yeah, Putin. In Moscow. And if anybody falls for the routine, that this is something that's new and it's going to be a strong relationship that we're all going to benefit from, because that's the pitching point, then you need to really examine some of the things that's been put in your diet. Let's talk to Alexander Sherba, our good friend, the former Ukraine ambassador to Austria and member of Ukraine's diplomatic mission to the United States. And Ambassador Sherba is very, very clear with his points and very clear with the issues that he brings forward as far as the relationship is concerned between Ukraine and China and Ukraine and Russia. Ambassador, good to have you with us. What did you come away with?
Hello, Roy. Good to be with you again. We were, of course, watching very closely what was happening in Moscow. And very often it was a feeling of deja vu in the way that Russia was behaving towards China like, I don't know, Ukrainian or Kazakh leaders were behaving when visiting Moscow in the Soviet times, you know, plenty of, you know, flattery, plenty of, you know, attempts to be likable by the big boss in the center. And and China's actually desire, well, the readiness to give some of propaganda to Putin and some of the results that Putin wanted in terms of propaganda, but not much outside of that. So there are two things that are interesting for Putin right now in relation with China. A, you know, keeping up the support within the country, so propaganda, and two, the weapons. And he received plenty of the first, but not much of the second. That's my take.
So I gather your take is you're not surprised at anything that happened in Moscow. Nothing.
Well, quite frankly, it had its logic in the way that on the one hand, China is definitely not interested in seeing Russia being crushed in this war, but they also see that Russia is not winning this war just putting all their eggs into this basket just doesn't make much sense for President Xi. Therefore, there was huge, you know, enthusiasm and almost, you know, tasteless, you know, accolades on the part of Russia, and very, very visible constraint on the part of the Chinese delegation. So I think President Xi is trying to walk this delicate line between not letting Russia being you know, destroyed in this war on the one hand, but also not destroying the relations with the West. I think so far he is doing more or less good.
So let me just read this line to you. This is from Global News. Russia has struck a deal with neighboring Belarus to station tactical nuclear weapons on its territory, but will not violate non-proliferation agreements. This is according to Putin, and this news is 28 minutes old.
Yeah. Well, it just, you know, for Russian, for Putin, it's very important to keep his people happy and thrilled, and they are thrilled every time they get reminded of how things were under the Soviet Union. So this is one of the things that reminds them of the good old time when the whole world was anticipating what would be the next step of the Soviet Union, and the whole world had, you know, fear for those steps. I don't think that militarily it means anything, because his whole military might is in Ukraine right now, and he knows that the big counteroffensive in Ukraine is coming, and it will decide pretty much everything in this war. So it's as they say, a red herring, an attempt to somehow extend the game. But people who know this situation, in this how situation is in Ukraine, how it's developing for Putin, they know that the main most important thing is Donbas and south of Ukraine.
So this does not surprise you that Russia has this deal with Belarus to station tactical nuclear weapons on its territory, but they say they'll not violate the non-proliferation agreements. So nothing surprising to you there, but big picture, what does it mean to the rest of the world? Is it just messaging, or is there more to this?
Well, you know, they're trying to raise the stakes. So the closer the tactical nuclear weapons are to each other on both sides of Belarusian-Polish border, the more tense the world becomes, and Russians are enjoying this tension. This is all what is this whole situation is about. So this whole situation, I mean, this you know, despair that sometimes one can hear in the or feel in the air in the West, it's a problem for the West, but it's an accomplishment for Russia. Therefore, and they're playing this game very good. So the tactical weapons will probably be now closer. I don't know how close to each other, but again, it's just another attempt to play with on the nerves of the West. That's the main thing.
Is this a signal beyond the headline?
Well, I think it's a signal for Russian population, first of all, that yes, we are going to pull all the levers, we are going all 9 yards and everything, but it's a bluff, and it's even more bluff towards the West, and it's this desperate attempt to somehow stop what looks like more and more inevitable, crushing Ukrainian counteroffensive coming during this year. This is the main event of this year, maybe of this decade, that will shape how things will develop in the whole region, maybe even beyond. And, well, other than that, Putin is trying just to look big for the so-called deep Russian people outside Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Is there a greater chance now that they'll actually use tactical nukes?
What would that give them? They just, it's just senseless. It makes no sense. Of course, this whole war makes no sense. That's why we were so wrong when he started this war, because it was so suicidal for Russia, and nevertheless he did it. So there is always a chance that the man is completely unhinged and crazy and insane. But in my opinion, he was just stupid. He was just overconfident in February 2022, and right now he's just trying to play this mad game. Madman game, you know. So he's trying to look intimidating, unpredictable, but truly, he is just deep inside. He understands that he is losing, and his only chance is to really make people scared in Ukraine, in the West, wherever in the world.
Is there a continuance here? Is there are there new developments? Are there predictable developments? Is this just a series of moves, that like a chess game that Putin is engaging on with the Americans and with his allies in Belarus?
Well, quite frankly, there are two big events that everybody was looking forward to during this year, and that would decide actually the flow of this war after that. That was Russian offensive and Ukrainian counteroffensive. The Russian offensive has started late last year, early this year, in the town of Bakhmut. Now, 3 months later, it's still in the town of Bakhmut. So we have seen what they're capable of. Now there is something big coming. And I feel, I see, I hear this fear coming from all these, you know, Russian journalists, Russian politicians. They don't know what is coming upon them. Of course, there is huge tension in Ukraine too, because we don't want to be disappointed. And we understand that from this strike that Ukraine will exert, will depend everything, and it must be crushing. So this is everything else, including the games that Russia is trying to somehow lead with Western elites, for instance. I see it in in Europe, for instance, how they are trying to, use this discontent within these anti-vaxxer groups in every European society. They're trying to somehow stretch their tentacles and trying to, help these demonstrations in France, whatever. But this everything is just on the margin. The most important thing is our coming counteroffensive. Sorry for sounding monotonous, but this is how it is.
All right. Do you expect, and you and I talked about this last time you were on with us, that at some point these tactical nukes are going to be used by Russia?
Well, these tactical nukes would bring Russia nothing. It would be the most insane step, including in relations with China and India, including for the reputation of Russia. What Russia counts upon, and this is they think it's serious. It might be indeed be serious. Is this anti-Western alliance they're trying to build at first with China, and during the summer they're conducting this Russia-Africa summit, and they want to build this big anti-Western momentum. This is what you should look at, not Russia's rhetoric. We might use the nuclear. If they use the nukes, they lose the global south, so they won't do that.
What will they do?
When will they do?
No, what will they do?
What will they do? They will try to build this global coalition against the West. So using their connections and influence within the BRICS countries, so Brazil, Russia, India, China, they will try to use all kinds of, whatever left of influence in the West, social democrats, leftists, the nationalists, all kinds of freaks, anti-vaxxers. Their name is Legion. I mean, there are really many people who are in the West, especially, who are not ready to listen to anything coming from their government and to practically everything that comes from Putin for some reason. So it's still there, up their sleeve. But the reasonable people, the people with conscience and with clear line between good and evil, they understand, I think, in the West, what is what in this war, and where is the evil and where is the good. Therefore, I count on that. I am a faithful person. I count on God, because, never in the newest history this line was as clear as it is right now.
We knew something was coming. President Xi was not going to be leaving China to go to see Putin in Moscow without some major announcement following. That was going to always be part of the trip, wasn't it not?
Well, I suppose Putin is a little bit disappointed in that regard, because the biggest announcement that President Xi did, that was in the last minutes of the visit, when he was saying goodbye to Putin, and the interpreter was interpreting very loud for Putin so that the journalists would hear. And President Xi said, well, this what we have started, nobody has tried anything like that in a very, very long time. And everybody is intrigued. What have they started? Does this mean that Xi is really on board with Putin? But again, I think it's just China's attempt to sound mysterious and to sound more on the side of Russia, more than acting on the side of Russia.
Okay.
That's my feeling.
We talked a lot about Bill C-69 on this program. And C-69 has implications for everybody in Canada. And there was a real effort made by the federal political parties to challenge C-69, which was favored by Mr. Trudeau and the Liberals. But what exactly does C-69 offer? What does it suggest? What is it going to bring your way and my way? Let's talk about that. And joining us is Catherine Brownlee. She's president of the Alberta Enterprise Group, and they are involved with this particular piece of legislation before the Supreme Court of Canada. Ms. Brownlee, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. First of all, C-69, what's the significance of C-69 in March of 2023?
Well, unfortunately, it's a significant change for many of us. We already are at a situation in Canada, and certainly I'll speak from Alberta just because I'm representing Alberta Enterprise Group, but we feel that it's just another layer of regulatory control, and unfortunately without any direct guidelines as to how long assessments would take for any project. It would need to be approved provincially and federally, and it's just layers and layers of red tape. And already we are, I think it was 2017, we were ranked 64th country in able to turn a large project and get it approved. And this layer will make it much worse than that.
Are you surprised that C-69 continues to generate as much attention and receives as much attention as it is receiving from the federal government in the spring of 2023? I think many people would have said, just a subjective opinion here, but I think many people might have said 2 years ago, look, they'll decide, they'll do away with this, and they'll just quietly make sure that it's not a prominent issue as we head into the next federal election. Looks like it's going to be exactly that. It'll be a prominent issue that the Liberals are going to take to the bank.
Yeah, certainly they definitely want to take this to the bank, as you said. They are focused on it because they want to ensure that resources that they are not necessarily in agreement with are locked down, and yet we will continue bringing resources from other countries into Canada, where ours, I'll just use energy, oil and gas as an example, that ours is much cleaner than other parts of the world, yet we still continue to bring it in and sell ours at wholesale.
How does C-69 affect us? By us, I mean collectively in this country, our 10 provinces and our territories as well. How does it affect us as far as doing our business is concerned and doing it productively?
There's countless reasons as to what this will do to us. Already investors have turned, there's more outgoing investment from Canada than incoming. This will make it much worse. Global investors are always looking for, as we know, the opportunity where there is more yes than no. And unfortunately, they've already seen Canada as the no country, and certainly, unfortunately, where Alberta is in all of this, and even Saskatchewan, of course, this is directly affecting us. And I personally think that, and this is not an AEG, this is just me personally, I've been in oil and gas for 30 years. My family was in oil and gas, and we're proud Albertans in that way, that we're proud of our resources. And we feel that this is yet another way to lock us down. We are landlocked here. We need to get to Tidewater. We need to be able to get this out to market. And this, again, is yet another layer of shutting us in.
So the Trudeau government has its agenda. It had its agenda when C-69 was introduced. It's the same agenda now in March of 2023. And it's out of touch with the realities of this year. And it's out of touch with the needs of this country. What would you suggest would be the most productive way of dealing with C-69? Rewrite it completely, drop it and start all over again, or is C-69 completely out of touch with what's relevant now?
It's certainly out of touch. If we wish to establish a framework to strengthen Canada's economy and future prosperity, then we need a better development regulatory process. This would be a process that appropriately balances the care for the environment we all want with the economic and resource development we need within appropriate constitutional boundaries to ensure prosperity now and for our future.
Share with us, please, what C-69 in fact means to the average Canadian.
Well, the average Canadian that I have heard from, and I'm sure you have in Saskatchewan, is that we already feel that we are shackled with every move we try to make. That is our current state. When this, if the federal government is successful, this will truly lock us down. It will be years to get approval on assessments. It will be, it's just truly trying to block us in every possible way.
So this is the objective of Mr. Trudeau, regardless of 100%. What else he may say, the objective is to lock the Prairie provinces in.
100%. That's my opinion. It's Alberta Enterprise member opinions. And it's also something that we've noticed since his father was in as our prime minister. I think this is just where he picks it up after his father left it, and he's seen this through.
What's the most effective way of countering C-69?
Doing what we're all doing, intervening, get behind the groups that are already involved and at the Supreme Court level, help them do their work, the very best of their ability. We've co-partnered on this one with ICBA. It's a large Canadian organization as well that feels the same way we do. We have a great constitutional lawyer. If there are listeners out there that want to get involved with either ICBA or AEG or other organizations like ours that are doing our best to intervene, I recommend that getting behind them. We're already lobbying. We're registered lobbyists. We're active, and we're not going to give up. So if they want to come in behind and support, that would be very much appreciated.
So how much support are you getting from the average Canadian, from the Canadian family, not only in the Prairie provinces, but on the east and the west coast as well? What are you hearing from the people who actually ultimately are going to have the final say? Because we know an election is coming. It has to happen in the next 2 years. What are you expecting?
Well, admittedly, as the president of AEG, my focus has really been our Alberta members.
Right.
I certainly do have a large network from my own consulting practice, and I have friends across the country. I would say that our Prairie provinces are 99% in agreement with how we feel about stopping this whole process and relooking at it, or blow it up and start all over again. But I do have pockets of people across Canada that don't. There's another part that does not even understand that this is happening, doesn't even know what Bill C-69 is, doesn't understand the implications of it. And then there's some very small pocket, generally my friends that are in the Toronto area, Ontario area, Quebec. Not all. I mean, Quebec is very, very much aligned with us in many ways too. But I will say that the friends that I have in Ontario just are going along with whatever the Prime Minister says is true and fact and good. They're in full belief that whatever he says is good.
So the Alberta Enterprise Group sees the Supreme Court as being a functionary for the Prime Minister's office.
Well, the Prime Minister's office actually put and assigned many of the leaders that are in the Supreme Court into those roles. So personally, I think there's definitely a large liberal contingent that is there. Absolutely.
What's your greatest fear?
That this actually passes through without enough of us fighting back.
And do you think that there's a realistic chance that that could in fact happen?
100%.
So we have the by-election in the city of Toronto for mayor, and we have another election coming up in the United States of America. The Donald Trump election, as somebody called it the other day. I happened to be watching a news channel, and they called it the Donald Trump election. And one of the people who was on that panel said, are you saying that this is about Donald Trump? And the person said, yeah, absolutely. It's not about anybody else. You wouldn't be here if it weren't for Donald Trump. So it's the Donald Trump election campaign, is it? It is, is it? So you can answer your question before you ask it in this case. So, of course, Mr. Trump has his troubles. Are they now sufficient in number and scope that the former president of the United States must resign the arguably most powerful office in the world before he can run for it again? My good friend John Zogby is with us, johnzogbystrategies.com. He's one of the United States' leading pollsters nationally, internationally as well. His book, well, he has many, but the book that I enjoy is We Are Many, We Are One. And John joins us on The Roy Green Show. How are you, John?
Hey, good, Roy. How have you been?
I'm fine. I'm trying to get through with Canadian elections, by-elections, American elections, not by-elections, but American elections. Looks like everybody has a pencil in their hand these days. So here we are. And before I ask you anything specific, the generic question, who's the favorite?
Oh, right now, I think it's a tie. Actually, depending on the poll, some have Trump ahead by a couple of points, or DeSantis on the Republican side over Biden. Others have Biden in the lead by one or two. It's it is too close to call.
So is this good news for Mr. Trump, or is this bad news for the former president?
It is bad news for Mr. Trump, simply because one would expect if the incumbent is as unpopular as he says the incumbent is, then, and if he is indeed the unquestioned front runner for the Republican nomination, again, as he says, then he should be polling over 50% and beating a, quote, unpopular, unquote, president. But that's in his mind. And so it is bad news. Even with a tie, remember, we have still very high inflation. We still have a president who, while his polling numbers have been edging up a little bit, you know, at about 46% approval, the current president is still very much in the game.
So regardless of how challenging the environment may become politically for Mr. Trump, he's still in the game.
He's still in the game. Yeah, he clearly, you know, there is opposition to Mr. Trump within his own party. There are among independents as well. And so it's going to be very difficult for him to grow support. I mean, the bottom would have to completely fall under Joe Biden or whoever the Democratic nominee will be. I suppose, you know, it will be Joe Biden. But yeah, Donald Trump, everybody knows who he is. I mean, so everybody's formed an opinion on him. It's not a favorable balance in terms of their opinion on him. But he has to grow from where he is, and his opportunities to grow, are not substantial.
John, are these numbers that are not favorable toward Mr. Trump, are they sufficient in number and scope that he must resign the arguably most powerful office, public office in the world?
Well, he doesn't hold public office.
You know what I mean, though. You know what I mean.
No.
So emotionally has to resign it.
Well, you know, this last time around there were about 15 or 16 Republicans splitting the vote against him, and you know, in the early runs he got just enough, a little bit more than just enough, to knock out some folks, and then he built momentum and the Republicans rallied around him. Now there are only a few candidates. I want to talk about Ron DeSantis in a few minutes if we get a second. Trump has enough right now, maybe to be considered the front runner, but he doesn't have a majority of Republicans. And there is real opposition to him, not only among moderate Republicans, but conservative Republicans. He also, at this point in time, seems to be on a very personal level falling apart at the seams, maybe crossing a line where it's time to start questioning, you know, his public behavior. A few examples. He's on the verge of being indicted in New York. Last night he went on social media, his own social media, with a baseball bat, threatening the prosecutor and pledging death and destruction if he's charged with any crime. All this within 24 hours of the prosecutor receiving an envelope with white powder in it and a note saying, I will kill you. Now, that's not from Trump, but it's just what it is a confluence of events that, you know, are making a lot of people scratch their heads.
I can only imagine this must have shaken you and startled you for a former president to be making a statement like that.
It is. And, you know, you want to say, well, you've become sort of inured to this sort of thing, but this is way over the top. I mean, so much so that his own wife says, I don't want to have anything to do with any of this anymore. I'm going to protect my son. And his daughter, Ivanka, and her husband are as far away from all of this by design as they can get. So his world seems to be falling apart. You know, he's got a solid base, but it's not as rock solid as it had been.
So when you look at the candidates that are running for the presidency, John, who do you favor at this point? Who would you, as a pollster, say the situation as it exists today on the 25th of March, 2023, favors? Who does it favor?
I would have to say Joe Biden. Now, even though 62% of voters don't want Joe Biden to run again, and that includes the majority of Democrats, but the fact of the matter is, when offered with a choice, voters seem to be more favorable to Biden or more unfavorable to Trump. Ron DeSantis is competitive going against Joe Biden. But again, you know, given the problems that the United States finds itself in, it's really amazing that, you know, the opposition isn't well ahead of the incumbent. So Joe Biden is kind of holding his own right now, and holding his own even better given what's happening in the opposition party.
So now we have Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
We have Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
We have Ron DeSantis.
Mm-hmm.
We have others somewhat well known, some not so well known. Certainly, they all are going to have a profile very quickly. Mm-hmm. Run for president of the United States, you can't help but get a profile. And of the whole crew, of all of them, who has the personality, and or how important is the personality aspect of the candidate, John? Okay. How significant is the personality aspect?
Oh no, the personality is very important. You have to like the candidate as a person. You have to be able to bond with them somehow. You know, up until Trump, who in so many ways broke all of the rules, generally the smiling, more affable candidate wins the presidency. I mean, arguably, he was more affable and more funny than Hillary Clinton in 2016. But in this case, I mean, the edge clearly goes to Joe Biden. Joe Biden is always able to turn on that everyman personality, that Irish pal slapping your shoulder at the bar, Uncle Joe. And then, of course, like so many other successful presidential candidates, he has a humanizing story about his father and then, of course, about his son who passed away. And that, of course, is... beyond tragedy, what it is a bonding story.
So at this moment, on the 25th of March, 2023, you would say the front runner, emotionally, would be Biden.
I do, yes.
And then does Trump have enough gas in the tank to potentially overcome any lead that Biden has?
Well, he's going to have to, like he did in 2016, rally the Republican base and then win among independents. He was able to do that in 2016, you know, by virtue of the fact that he ran against someone who was least trusted to tell the truth than he was, and less affable. In 2020, the gas tank was, you know, on a quarter full, you know, for Donald Trump, and he ran against someone who was, you know, kind of the antithesis of Donald Trump. So this time around, he's got a lot more baggage. You know, I'm being very cautious here. It looks like he will be indicted in New York, in Georgia for, you know, election tampering, in Washington for, you know, possessing and meaning no good by having classified documents, and then having to have his home raided because by the FBI because he refused to turn over those classified documents. So it looks like he's in a heap big amount of trouble. And that, you know, that can't help. At the very least, what it does is it takes the off message.
Well, it's fascinating, and I'm not just saying that. I'm not playing word games here. It is fascinating to see this develop, to see Donald Trump. Yeah. Some would argue he's the incumbent. I know he's not. But some would argue that he's the incumbent, and therefore he has the strength on his side. He isn't, and he doesn't, but some would say that. It is going to be fascinating to see how this develops over the next, how many months? This is almost just over a year, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's just under a year when the primaries begin.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'll begin the first week of February, and then, yeah, we're looking at just a year and a half until the general election. You know, we never rule Donald Trump out. Let me be clear on that. But he's got some disadvantages this time around that he didn't have the two previous times.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
3 nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.